Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of May 19th, 2016. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Good, good. And today we're also happy to be joined by Fran McIntyre, who is a lawyer with extensive experience in litigation, and it works the firm of Capolis, Connors, and Carroll. How are you doing, Fran? Welcome.
Just great. Happy to be here, Ted.
Great, great. So this was a pretty big week, in climate news that's so big we kind of have to put the whole thing into context. So let me take a stab at that. You guys can correct me when I'm done. First of all, we're going to talk about a topic that happens, a legal topic, but it's an important one, I think, for the nation because Massachusetts is kind of the thin edge of the wedge on a lot of these issues. I mean, what happens here will be played out in other states. So even if you're not listening in Massachusetts, the interaction of what's going on here, you may see echoes of that in your own state. The second thing I think is really interesting about what we're going to talk about is how legal issues are becoming more and more important in the climate movement. I mean, you know, we're now... 10 years ago, we were talking about getting people to take shorter showers. And now we are looking at real, concrete, legal activities. So that's in the background. So some of the things that happened this week are the following. Earlier in the week, we got a news report in the Boston Globe that said carbon dioxide emissions in Massachusetts were rising. Right? Mm-hmm. And this is in contradiction to a law that's been passed called the Global Warming Solutions Act, which said that Massachusetts must reduce its carbon emissions by 25% by the year 2020. Mm-hmm. Right? So it turns out that, according to the article, the reason the carbon dioxide emissions have bumped up is because the Vermont nuclear power plant, which of course does not burn carbon fuel, that went offline, and so other carbon plants had to come on, yada, yada, yada. But that was a fact. So that's one fact. The other fact is that there is something called the Omnibus Energy Bill, which is an attempt to reconcile a lot of Massachusetts state policy. That is in play right now. The Global Warming Solutions Act that I just mentioned made a call for carbon dioxide emissions reductions, but it never clearly said that they had to happen. The goals that were set, the 25% reduction by the year 2020, were essentially nice things to have. You know, please try and do this. And if you don't do it, well, it doesn't really matter. So tell me, DR, let me put the ball in your court. What big thing happened this week that changed the ground rules a little bit?
Well for a bit of more perspective, I think we mentioned before that with regard to a case that was filed known as Kane versus Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection, the hope was that the Supreme Judicial Court would make a ruling as monumental as the 2003 ruling authorizing marriage equality in Massachusetts Goodrich versus Department of Public Health. And in a bit of a serendipity, on May 17th, 12 years to the day after same-sex marriages began in the Commonwealth as a result of Goodrich versus Department of Public Health, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court issued a ruling known as Kane versus Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection that stated that the current administration has not complied with the 2008 Global Warming Solutions Act and has failed to recognize the plain language of the ruling, which states that Massachusetts must set specific targets. They're not supposed to be aspirational goals. They're supposed to be hard caps, as the Boston Globe notes, in order to get greenhouse gas emissions 25% below 1990 levels by 2020. As I read the ruling, it reminded me of a saying that a lot of evangelical Christians use about how the Ten Commandments are not the Ten Suggestions. essentially, what the Supreme Judicial Court said was that the indications in the Global Warming Solutions Act were not suggestions, they were commandments that the state has to take firm and aggressive and clear action to get greenhouse gas emissions down. They're not supposed to be lofty pie in the sky goals. They're supposed to be, again, orders to take action.
And somehow this is, well, okay. So Fran, tell me, in terms of, so we've got the Supreme Judicial Court, which is the highest court in Massachusetts, has interpreted Massachusetts law to say that the state government must act to reduce carbon emissions according to a specified target. It's mandatory. So what does that mean, Fran? What should we take out of the ruling? I mean, if we were trying to do it before and we weren't doing a very good job of it, the SJC says we must do it. What happens now?
Well, first, what happens now and then really what has happened this week is that there's a clear understanding of what the Global Warming Solutions Act called for. Where previously DEP had thought that it was just a progress that was looked for, not a hard cap, now the court said it is a hard cap, there's got to be concrete ceilings in place, and that they are obligated to promulgate regulations calling for declining emissions of greenhouse gases over time. And so suddenly what has come about this week is clarity about what the Global Warming Solutions Act really has been saying all of this time since it was passed in 2007. And then from that said that indeed the DEP had failed in its obligations under the Act. So now then the court has entered a declaration as to what the Global Warming Solutions Act means going forward in terms of Section 3D, which is where the obligation to promulgate these regulations arises. And so I would anticipate that the department will move to that because that's what the law obligates them to do.
But I mean, I guess the question is, so when you say regulations, that means effectively, I think we've talked about this in the past, that regulations are the articulation of how to achieve the intent of the law. And regulations essentially have the force of law. But does that mean that the regulations will order power plants to shut down? Or, I mean, do we even know yet? Is that too a bridge too far? We don't know that, but
what's... Not according to the terms of what I see there. What it seems to set is aggregate limits over categories, from source categories or individual sources. And so that
Would typically, a source typically being a power plant or kind of power plant or automobiles or things like that. Yeah, okay.
But it seems to be directed more generally and not at specific entities from what I saw in the language of the ruling, that it refers to categories, so it refers to sources or categories of sources. And it refers to setting limits, aggregate limits, limits that must decline, that must meet certain benchmarks, and that is the way it is framed, Ted.
Wow. But I mean, so it's interesting. So by the regulations require, I mean, I can see that would be a nightmare to implement, right? Because the state does not own the power plants that make power, right? So how are they? So they have to find a way, essentially, to induce EverSource to stop producing so much carbon dioxide. And that sounds like a carbon tax or something. It sounds like the direction they'd have to go to make that happen.
Well, I don't know. I mean, the Global Warming Solutions Act set forth a number of steps and duties that would be undertaken by DEP. And they were chronological. They had a certain progression to them. They were obligated to first set up a regime of reporting. They were obligated to determine what the levels of greenhouse gas emissions had been in 1990 and what they were anticipated to be in 2050 if business carried on as usual, and then to work within that. And so it seemed to be setting policy limits on the macro level, setting emissions limits on the macro level, not on the specific. But it seems as though the Global Warming Solutions Act required much of that infrastructure to be put into place between 2009 and 2011. 2012 is when they were to be promulgated.
Right.
The limits would be promulgated, and that's
the 25% at 2020. Right?
That's right. That,
interesting. I mean, so DR, have you seen anything about how the what's going to happen next? You're scanning the horizon all the time.
Well, there was an interesting analysis of this by Adam Gaffin of UniversalHub.com, who noted that as a consequence of this ruling, we could see Massachusetts devising automobile emission standards even tougher than those of California's, mm-hmm. which would be very, very interesting because if we remember the documentary Who Killed the Electric Car, we know about the influential role that California plays in limiting emissions from automobiles nationwide. So it'll be interesting to see the ramifications of that. It will also be interesting to see what the political ramifications are in the sense of, will we see the state legislature, you know, move to put as much clean energy as possible in the omnibus bill? Will we see the state legislature move to implement some form of carbon pricing as a means of complying with what is demanded by the court? Will we see the Baker administration potentially lean on Eversource and National Grid to sort of, you know, resurrect what seemed to be dead in terms of the various contractual agreements that would have allowed the Cape Wind project not to die? Could we actually see Massachusetts surpass California and become an international leader in clean energy? You know, there have been so many of these stories about how Denmark and Germany they've been getting, you know, these large percentages, 75%, 90% of their energy from non-fossil fuel-based sources. Could we see Massachusetts join those countries as being regions where they get a supermajority of their energy from clean sources as a result of this ruling?
I hear you, but the question I am wrestling with is how – I mean, so there is – Fran, you've said there's a requirement that the state put regulations out to meet certain emissions targets. And really what that translates to is somehow burning less fossil fuels, ultimately. Mm-hmm. That's what it gets down to, right? And that either means increasing the renewable energies or decreasing the burning of, say, natural gas. And the question is, what if the regulations exist? I mean, I can see a high political risk, because if the regulations are not done right and everyone gets mad because they don't have electricity some night, then that's going to come home to roost, right? And how, I guess, to your point, dear, how does the state government respond by, in ways that are not regulatory, right? If the omnibus bill significantly increased requirements for clean energy, that would satisfy the regulatory requirement sort of naturally. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Well, it ties into the issue that we recently addressed about the ruling out of Washington State, where a court ordered Washington State's Department of Environmental Protection to set some hard targets for cutting emissions. And we speculated as to whether or not, if Washington State passes I-732, the carbon pricing ballot initiative, would that satisfy the requirements of the court? It does remain to be seen if something similar can happen here, because we've seen a lot of, you know, media coverage, a lot of media speculation about the idea that the only way that the requirements of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court can be satisfied is if the state implements some form of economy-wide carbon pricing to force the ramping down of greenhouse gas emissions. So it'll be interesting to see that the sort of a combination of the legal and the political here, because obviously something has to be done, that the Baker administration and other officials can't simply ignore the ruling. And if you go back to the other precedent of marriage equality, you may remember when then Governor Mitt Romney and the state legislature tried to weasel their way out of the Goodridge ruling by saying, can we use some sort of proxy for marriage equality? And the court said, no, you have to implement marriage equality. Mm-hmm. So we could be seeing some very, very forceful remarks from the court here again, if the Baker administration and other elected officials try to finesse the plain text and the plain language of this ruling.
Well, Fern, what's the enforcement mechanism here? Right, so the DE, suppose, I mean, not that Governor Baker is going to not uphold the law, but I'm sure someone like from the Conservation Law Foundation is going to be watching very closely and will probably sue. Is that, I mean, what happens if you've got the Supreme Judicial Court's ruling and people are dissatisfied with the implementation process What happens?
Well, what I would anticipate is, in this case, there's been an entry of judgment. The declaration, the final six sentences of the court's opinion is basically a declaration of what the department's obligations are. That goes back to the Superior Court. The Superior Court will then issue that. And the litigation, the case, I believe, would remain open at that point. I would anticipate that there's already conversations going on between the Conservation Law Foundation and the department as to what the department anticipates is the time frame it's going to need mm-hmm. in order to comply with its now clear obligations. And if the CLF is satisfied or unsatisfied, I wouldn't be at all surprised if they're back before the court at some point seeking some time frame. You'll notice that the declaration that was set did not include any time frame. That wasn't part of the litigation. It will go back to the trial court to conclude other questions that appear.
When you say it, you mean this particular the court case associated with this Kane ruling kind of stays open now? So that people will come back and say, you're not meeting and it stays alive in the court?
Well, it at this point, all that's happened is there's been an entry of judgment. There hasn't been a final judgment entered.
Oh, really? Okay.
Uh-huh. Okay, so it goes back to the Superior Court. Superior Court will issue the declaration.
Okay.
And then the case remains open until there is a final judgment.
And when might that happen?
Well, if either the parties move for final judgment, but if the parties aren't fully satisfied, it would seem to me that they'd have this open case to return to the court to seek any further remedy that they might need. Or they can choose any other plaintiffs can become involved. They can mm-hmm. choose any other remedy, as can the department, as to how they proceed. But
it's not over until either the CLF or the DEP agree and go back and say, you know, we all agreed, please close this case. It just kind of stays open, lingering.
It stays open, right, until there's a final judgment that enters. Wow. So it remains open, and I would expect that they would go back to the court if they were not satisfied, that is the plaintiffs, as to the time frame that was being put into place by DEP.
Huh.
I would not expect the court to quickly involve itself in ordering a State Department as to how to carry out its business.
Right.
The court is the judiciary. Then they would be unlikely to be ordering the executive how to proceed. And there's no claim here of recalcitrance or negligence. It's simply a misunderstanding as to what the statute obligated them to do. And so what could potentially happen is they would go back to the court, that is the plaintiffs, if they were unsatisfied with the time frame. And then there can be things that follow from that. The Superior Court has the authority to use a variety of different sanctions in order to induce compliance with either the court's order, basically.
Wow. I like that phrase, induce compliance. That sounds kind of scary.
As a practical matter, at this point is a declaration. Everybody will assume the declaration will be complied with. If there is some failure in that regard, I would anticipate the parties would go back before the court and seek a court order that exact specifications of the declaration be carried out by a certain date.
Mm-hmm.
And if they fail to meet that certain date, then come back before the court for further hearings as to whether there was contempt of the court's order. And then there can be a variety of different sanctions and that might follow from that. But I think that you could anticipate that a state agency is going to be most unlikely or unwilling to face that type of a consequence.
In contempt of court. Oh, man. Well, look, this has been a big week. We kind of have to leave it here because it's a huge topic. Lots and lots of stuff to cover. Let me tell everyone that's listening that we'll put up some links to these various articles we've talked about at the blog. It's massclimateaction.net/blog. You'll be able to find this podcast on Facebook. It's /massclimateaction is our Facebook page. Please share us with your friends so they can hear us. You can listen to us on your smartphone using Stitcher or TuneIn Radio. And, of course, you can find us on iTunes. You go to the podcast section and search for Massachusetts Climate Action. So we'll close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. Well, thank you very much for being here, DR.
Thanks.
And friend, thank you very much for taking the time to come chat.
You're very welcome.
And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.